episodes of Times Like Now can be heard wherever you get your podcasts. For the last year, I've been doing an episode every week. I am now reverting to once monthly, wherever you hear your podcasts, as well as Pacifica Radio Networks. My name is Trevor Collins, and I can be reached, Trevor, at Times Like Now. A special thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. Thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to speaking with you all next time.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Noel Taylor. He's a surreal abstract painter, and his work is visible now at noeltaylorart.com. Thanks for doing Art Focus, Noel.
Thank you, Joseph. Good to be here.
This work is it's like visionary art. It's also, you can also call it organic surrealism, because a lot of the shapes kind of look like plants or animal matter or human tissue or, you know, animal tissue. But it's very bright, bold oil painting with they're all finished with a varnish. So this is a sort of classical style of painting, but you brought it to a, you know, very modern kind of visionary way of producing art. We're standing in front of one of the bigger pieces, which is about like 4 by 3 feet. What I see is a huge kind of red background, which itself is mottled and sort of marbled. That's just the background. And then there are these shapes at the forefront. There's sort of blue bulges and then red, yellows, and very, very complex sort of fluid dynamics going on. It's as though you, like a Rorschach blot, when you squish painting and then open the fold and it's moved of its own volition. But all this is very, very deliberately painted. Does this piece have a name? And then what can you tell us about how you make it?
This is a brand new piece. We're still working on the name. My wife helps me with names. She really loves the idea that this evokes the image of a butterfly for her, so it may end up being called Butterfly. We'll discuss that some more.
But, I mean, I see kind of viscera, you know, it's as though you've torn an animal open and inside are the guts, and you can see in the transparency of these shapes. But it could also be a kind of marbling or liquid, colored liquid spilled. But it's completely abstract. This is visionary painting, visionary art. That's in the sense that you see a vision. And usually in like psychedelics, people, when they try and paint what they've seen, they stick to a set group of imagery, type of animals, flowers, you know, there'll be the moon and the sun in there. It's like a system of symbols that people keep returning to. But you choose total abstraction.
I choose abstraction. I try not to anthropomorphize anything or put symbolism of any kind in there. I would rather it be a raw experience, a window or point of reflection, if you will, so that people can look in and see exactly what they need to see or discover what they can find. They're focal points. They definitely are a meditation when I create them, and I hope that they provide a point of meditation for the viewer. Because they are still abstracted, everyone will see what they want to see. They'll see something different in each of these. I've seen people will look at the same painting and some will see some sort of alien landscape, or another person will see coral reefs, or they all find what they need to find. Some will personalize them and see their pet in them, whatever they need to see. That's fine with me. I like having art that's evolving and also provocative and evocative.
You used to paint, you know, like very traditional landscapes and portraits, I think, and you were really into Rembrandt, and you studied the fine art techniques of, you know, the last 500 years. What is the Miche technique?
The Miche technique was primarily developed by Flemish artists in the 16th and 17th century. They used it mostly for florals and still lifes. It gives the painting a sense of backlighting. It makes it look stained glass, if you will. And I loved that method, and when I was painting classically, I always enjoyed that technique, but I knew that I wasn't using it to its full artistic extent that I wanted to take it. So I applied Miche technique, which is essentially using all transparent oil paints and not using any opaques except for white, and using a white canvas, painting in layers and letting each layer dry before you put the next layer. That way, since they are translucent, the light refracts from the canvas in back and the eye mixes the colors. That gives them a vibrance and a transparency that I really enjoy.
So you take regular oil paints and do you kind of thin it down to make it transparent?
No, if you look on the tubes of oil paint themselves, it'll give you an opaqueness scale. Some are completely transparent, so that means it's just light suspension in the medium and that the pigment itself is partially transparent all the way to opaque, and you'll see medium transparency all the way to opaque. So there's a scale on all of your paint.
For your sort of turquoisey blue that looks kind of like Crest toothpaste, okay. Is that how it comes out of the tube?
No.
Like semi-transparent?
No, that's several different colors that mix my blue there. I'm using a blue indigo as a base, which is very dark, and I go in very light with that, and I work all the way up to a turquoise. There's probably six different blues to cause all the layers in the blue that you're looking at there. So it doesn't come out of the tube that way. No, I have to create my colors because I'm doing them in layers. But that gives me the depth and the transparency, the glass-like effect that I like.
You start with a white canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you said. No matter how many layers you put on of different colors, the light penetrates those layers, hits the white, and then comes back and mixes.
For example, a green would be easy to describe. A layer of yellow, say an Indian yellow, let it dry, and over that a light layer of a blue, cerulean blue, and then let that dry, and then go over that with a bright yellow, and then over that with another blue, and what you'll have there is your eye refracting the light and mixing all those colors. If I don't make it a flat where it's all even, I can put blotches of different colors, and so you'll have different intensities of the color. So it'll go in and out and give it that texture that you look at underneath. It looks like it's inside of the ball. That's how that's created, with different degrees and thicknesses of the transparent oil paint.
What's kind of remarkable about this work is the range, the sort of multiplicity of shapes that you come up with, because they don't refer to the real world like the shape of a tree or a hill or a face. You can do anything. Like, any shape can go off in any direction at any time. There do seem to be some rules, like, you know, surface tension, the way things become spherical when they're sticking out.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking now at this other one. It's on a beautiful blue and black background. It looks like one piece floating on a background. Some of them go right to the edge and, you know, they're cut off. But this seems to be like a single piece. It's yellow, and it does have that kind of human fat kind of yellow, that golden sunshine color you see on, like, medical videos. And that shape within it has, like, egg-shaped indentations and cells. There are some long tubes coming out, and at the ends of them they have transparent buds that are kind of like Christmas lights or larvae, you know, transparent water creatures, you know, when they're still at a larval stage. It is kind of very alien, you know. It's got that very, what would you call that? It's just a very, very complicated shape that doesn't seem to follow any rules. Where does this shape come from?
It's a great question. I get in a state when I'm creating these where I let them create themselves. I get a sense that I'm dipping my hand into a Jungian cosmic consciousness, a stream, and catching a part of this as it goes by and then letting it spill out onto my canvas through my paints. I watch myself paint these, and it's like automatic painting. I don't start with a plan or an idea. I simply wear myself down until I am in a space where I'm no longer trying to force a painting to come out. I let it come out, and I get a sense of watching myself from behind painting these, letting the painting flow through me. And after I reincorporate, if you will, I look at the painting, and it's as much a surprise to me as it would be to anyone. I can't tell you where it came from, how I created it, but I always feel humbled by being part of the process. Now, over time, then I will go back to this painting and I will sculpt in the details. I will give it the depths and the color combinations that I want it to have, and that's when I model it and highlight it, and that's what gives it the motion it has in it. The process is a meditative and I'd say spiritual journey for me, and these become windows of contemplation for me and hopefully for the viewer also.
You talked about automatic painting.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when people say that, it's kind of a way of saying, well, I did this in a hurry.
I didn't
spend very long on this.
Some of these paintings took years to paint.
These are incredibly labor intensive.
Very.
And what always amazes me is when I talk to artists who say, yeah, I made this painting and I like sanded it all off and started again,
mm-hmm.
or I painted over, or there are 12 layers of black for this black. And it's like, all right, they're seeing something that we are not seeing.
Mm-hmm.
The process of making it is incredibly different from the process of consuming it or looking at it. So with these, you start off with like one image, like a shape, and you take a big brush and outline it, or what?
I start off with a brush. Usually a larger brush in the beginning. I have colors set up so that they're at my disposal. They're already mixed with the medium so that they're a fast drying medium that doesn't affect their transparency. I get out of the way. I let my brush decide which color it wants to start with, and I start with broad strokes. There's no shape in mind. I let that happen. I back up and I go through the process again and again and again. That way the color is set up without me thinking formulaic and going back to my color theory and how this will be with that, and I come up with generally bright and more shocking color juxtapositions than I would if I was simply thinking as the realist painter I once was. I like being surprised by what appears. It's a delight to be an observer of my own work where I'm seeing it like for the first time as it happens without visualizing it in my mind. I'm good at conceptualizing paintings, but at this time in my life, those come out and I can see that I planned this. I don't like that feeling anymore. I like it to happen to me instead of me making it. Very hard to explain, but it's not uncommon with artists. I've heard it described before, something like this. And it feels like I've been gifted when it happens, so I love being part of that process. It is exhausting, it is tedious, but I love it.
Well, how many hours would you spend on a wheel? Like, how many times would you just paint over?
Oh, my. I'll have 16-hour days where I didn't know the time passed, and I just keep going over it and over it and over it and wiping it off and going over it again and again until I finally stop thinking. It's my mind that gets in the way because I want to paint a good painting. My ego says, let's paint a masterpiece, until I let go of that concept and stop negotiating with it and just let it be. It doesn't happen until I get to that state. Then I get to that state and let it happen, and that's when I'm surprised. That's when I stop wiping it and I watch what appears. That can take a long time before I get into that state. So how many times? There's probably a dozen paintings under that painting, if that makes sense.
If you knock off for the day, and then you, how do you reaccess that feeling the next day?
I have to come back and find one spot on the painting to enter it. So I go, I observe the painting, I meditate on it, and then I will find one point that I'll be curious about, and I'll step forward, look at that. I'll enter there and start painting from that point out. On the corner, the center, wherever it appears to me, and I start painting from one point, the painting will develop from that one point all the way out.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is painter Noel Taylor. His work is available at noeltaylorart.com. Right next to this, the big blue one with the sort of yellow adipose tissue, is this different one. It looks a lot flatter, and it has this cross-sectional feel. It's like a cross-section of like a brain, you know, where there's sort of the edges are very sharp. I don't know how you describe that shape. It's kind of like a cloud with gaps in it on a reddish background, which is itself made up of different pools or, you know, like maggot shape. And then in the middle, there's this, you've actually used abalone type of paint, and it looks like a cross-section of a shell. So that's something we can all relate to, is, you know, the polished mother of pearl shell kind of imagery. Is that how you conceived of this?
I didn't conceive of this one at all like that. I started with a small squeegee on this to create a background in a white paint with mica suspended in it so that it would have some refracting light particles in the background. And then using transparent paint on top of that, you still see the light reflected off the little particles. So different angles you look at this will give you a different shine or sheen and a different texture. But I left texture on the background, and then as I started painting with color, I painted around the texture that appeared, and this is what appeared. There is a shell-like structure in there. I used, to get the colored background, a transparent oxide red, a burnt sienna, and I mixed them in different degrees and different layers, grain to model it, and this is what came out.
Did you say that the paint has mica in it?
Yeah.
Where do you get that?
You can get it at any of the local art stores.
Blick
has it, yeah.
What do you ask for?
Winsor & Newton. You can also get mica and mix it into your own white paint. It's more tedious, it's easier to buy it, and it's not that expensive.
So you were trained, you know, to paint traditional oil painting, mm-hmm. and you get down to these tiny brush sizes, the size zero, and you use that, you come back at the end, right, to highlight things in white, mm-hmm. which gives a kind of depth. It gives a gloss, you know, like if there's a bulbous shape, then you make a white highlights on it, and that gives it a three-dimensional character. It also looks a bit like airbrush,
mm-hmm.
but there's nothing about this work that's as fast as airbrush, right? You're doing this like one dot at a time.
When I was a very young man, I did do airbrush painting, but no, there's nothing really, there's nothing like airbrush in this. It is all one stroke at a time. I love brushwork. At one point, I studied sumi, Chinese ink painting, because I loved the lushness of ink releasing on paper with a very thick brush, with where you had your entry point, you swirled the brush and left. You had very dynamic brush strokes, mm-hmm. and that's where I kind of learned how to handle a brush, was with that type of brush painting, because I did study the Dutch masters like Rembrandt and such, I loved how they used a thick impasto type of paint. I do not go impasto with these because I'm using translucent paints, but I still like there to be a release, an entry and a release with each brush stroke, no matter how small. It's painting is kind of a sensual act, if for me anyway, I would think for most artists that really get into it. And that's something I enjoy doing when I paint.
So you paint both vertical on an easel and then also horizontal, so you can kind of lean over the work. We're looking now at a piece that's on an easel. It's done except it hasn't been varnished, so you can see a lot more of the texture of the paint, and you can see, I think the colors are not as bright when it's not varnished.
Well, there's a lot more grays in this painting than the ones you've just been looking at. Those are mostly primary colors, and a lot of the ones, these are mostly secondary colors in this, and I didn't keep any of the pure pigment in this particular one. I want it, it's more of a moody piece,
mm-hmm.
more of a dreamlike piece.
Right, yeah, I mean, it does look like, again, like a single figure or body on a kind of floating in clouds, in mist. There's clouds in the background and also a kind of mist that comes up from the bottom. You know, again, it's a sort of undescribable shape of triangle. It could be a big ear, but it has so many things in it. Like, again, it has kind of guts on the inside, pink bulbous canals, and then translucent shapes like the shell of a shrimp, maybe. And then there are these whirling kind of, sort of like the ear, the whirl of an ear. And then the top is a white kind of horn. Some of it is photorealistic. And then some of it is sort of pastel-y and very soft focus. Is this the same technique? Because it does look different from the other stuff.
It is the same technique. There's a little more white involved. And like I said, I took my colors and didn't leave them pure. When I did the layers on this one, I put colliding colors or colors that would go to a neutral. So they would make a type of gray, and I kept the gray dominant in most of the painting, and I really didn't put any pure color in this. What I mean by pure is right out of the tube. Everything here is a little receded and less defined. I tried to keep soft edges on this one. I wanted it to recede. I wanted a dreamlike look, because that's what appeared in the beginning when I started it. So I wanted it a touch vague, but I needed one part sharp to give it some definitions. Otherwise, it could have got lost, and I didn't want it to get lost.
And how long was it from when you started to when this final image arrived?
Oh, my. Let me think on that. This one for me came relatively quick. This was about 5.5 months.
And is that working on it a few hours a day?
Every day, yeah.
Every day?
Towards the end, I would put 10 hours in. Layers take a lot of time to do, and so there is no quick way to do Miche technique that I know of.
And when you're waiting for it to dry, you're working on another one?
Or I'm working on another part.
Oh, okay. So you can just move around the canvas.
I just spin the canvas, yeah.
Right.
Right.
How many do you have on the go at one time?
I've usually got five canvases. I've got five easels going at a time, usually.
But then this trance state where you're forgetting the image mm-hmm. and it's sort of coming to you, how do you...
That happens in the beginning. That happens for the laying down of the base of the painting. So I go through that process, and one painting has presented itself totally there, and then I let that cure and dry, and I can do that process on another canvas mm-hmm. in a couple days. So then I come back and do all the chiseling and the modeling and make it mm-hmm. make it come to
life.
Oh,
I see. So the creative kind of impulse that you've been searching mm-hmm. that can happen over a discrete period of time, like
yes.
2 days,
mm-hmm.
exactly. and then you can yeah. relax and just work on the image.
And using my technical skills to and that's got its own delight too. I like to paint. I enjoy it. Always have.
But your ego, which you tried to banish, that can come back and like finish the work.
It can come back also, but I can't let it take over what was stated in the beginning. Quite often, I will see symbolism appear, and my ego goes, "Yeah, go with that. Run with that."
What are your least favorite symbols?
Symbols in art become very cliche. And it makes them illustrative to me, and it makes them a little preachy. And usually, dogma is represented. I want a universal, and so I try to avoid representing anything at this stage. I've done plenty of representational art,
mm-hmm.
and so I try not to let symbolism and and realism come into it right mm-hmm. now.
Like, are there any symbols that you, like, you're walking around at an art fair in a, you know, a Saturday market kind of place, and mm-hmm. you see visionary art? Like, what are the type of symbols that you see and you think of?
It's not that I'm against, I see art with symbols in them that I like. Mm-hmm. That's just not what I'm doing right now. It's not, mm-hmm. that is being done, and that's done a lot by a lot of great people. Visionary art that I like, there's a lot of great artists right now that probably will never have an audience. It's very hard right now for a visual artist, oh boy, I almost got snobby there, but a painter, an oil painter, to get a wide audience. Even with internet right now, people, their attention span is so short, and they're shown so much information. A good painting, it takes effort to watch and look at it, to work, to observe it, to know it. And there's not as many people nowadays that want to sit and look at a well-painted painting. They generally want to walk by. And you notice that if you go to galleries or museums, people don't spend a lot of time with the painting. I go to a museum, I saw a Turner in Chicago, and I sat there for 12 hours looking at it.
Seriously?
They had to kick me out at the
end.
Were you?
Yeah. Just were you
I was blown away. I just sat there and I went, and I'd get as close as they would allow me to mm-hmm. it in all angles, trying to understand why this was so deeply evocative to me. It's simply pigment on canvas, but what was this deep thing it was touching? I think I saw the painting again in a James Bond movie, actually. Bond was sitting on a bench in a gallery, and Q came and sat beside him, and they had a conversation looking at a painting and making metaphors about the painting. It was quite funny. And my point was, the more you give a painting in observation, the more it'll give you. And so it's hard to find an audience that's willing to commit to actually observing a good painting. And when we were talking visionary art, probably my favorite visionary artist in recent years has been Robert Venosa. He affected me deeply. He passed a while back. Fortunately, I got to meet him. I found him very inspirational. He kind of pointed the direction I'd be going next. My work doesn't emulate him. It's inspired by his work. And so look up Robert Venosa. His stuff is really, I think, quite good. And it affects me in the way that I'm talking about, where I look at his paintings and I feel like I know them in some way, but I don't know why.
What's the idea of getting rid of your ego to see the image appear, but you don't want traditional image of, you know, some psychedelic thing of the whatever, mm-hmm. an animal or something? Are you seeing it as an image of something inside you? It's like part of you, like you're accessing your unconscious or your soul or something?
I do feel like I am accessing deep unconscious, when it doesn't necessarily feel that it's contained within me. It feels more of a universal tapping into a dream space or a cosmic consciousness of some sort. Painting is spiritual for me. I don't have any traditional religion that I can have found that I can adhere to, but having had experiences in my life that I can't explain, I've always explored, be it philosophically or with psychedelics or whatever, trying to find doorways to remember and windows into that space, and painting has definitely created those windows into that space.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was visionary painter Noel Taylor. His brand of organic surrealism is viewable now on his website, noeltaylorart.com. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Noel.
Thank you, Joseph.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him all now, whoa. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Eso, KBO.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes, primero de febrero del 2022. Los suecos lo han rechazado. El doctor Fauci dice que los Estados Unidos podría aprobarlo pronto. Los chinos han comenzado, pero los cubanos ya han vacunado a casi todos los niños pequeños contra el COVID. La isla es el único país que vacuna contra la enfermedad a niños pequeños de hasta 2 años, y más del 95% de los niños de 2 años a 18 años han sido vacunados por completo, según el Ministerio de Salud Pública. Aunque el COVID afecta a los niños con menos severidad, son un factor importante en la